Hello, I'm Dr. Peter Matthews, a senior lecturer in social policy at the University of Stirling. I'm here with Professor Kirsten Rummery to talk about women and welfare policy for the online module of SBCU 913, Understanding Social Policy. So, Kirsten, or Professor Rummery, what would you prefer?
Kirsten, please.
So, why is it important then to talk, just to even consider, why would we consider gender when we talk about social policy?
In the first instance, the same way that we would consider gender when talking about anything to do with wider society, women make up 52% of the population, and we know that your gender has a particular impact on how you experience the world, how you interact with the world, and how the world interacts with you. We all know that before we even start studying social sciences or trying to understand the reason for it. Why it's specifically interesting and important to take a gendered focus on welfare is for several reasons. One is that the way in which welfare policies pan out, in other words, the effect that they have on the general population and the people who are subject to those policies, differs dramatically according to gender. And I'll give you some examples of that in a minute. But the other reason is that if we're looking at it both from a big high-level state perspective, which is, you know, how much money we put into the system, what kind of policies we have, what kind of outcomes we get, who's paying into the system, who's working to pay taxes to pay for the system, that has a highly gendered aspect to it, who's running the system in terms of who's making the policy decisions about where money gets spent in certain areas and what policies happen, that has a highly gendered aspect. Who's running the system on the ground in terms of who the welfare professionals are, the doctors, the nurses, the teachers, the social workers, the people working in the departments of work and pensions, the people working in housing offices and places like that, the people, if you like, who are actually implementing social policy, how that happens is a highly gendered thing. And the outcomes, how they actually affect people in on the ground, people living in families, people working, people not working, people looking after kids, people caring, people taking part in their communities, that all of that aspect is highly gendered. So all of the, from whatever perspective you take it, whether you're looking at the structure of society, whether you're looking at theories that help us understand why we have some kinds of welfare policies and not other kinds of welfare policies, or whether you're looking at the evidence of how policy is made, how it's implemented, and what the outcomes of those policies are, all of that has a specifically gendered focus, and people experience it differently depending on their gender.
Brilliant. Awful lot to unpack there. And I think you mentioned at the start of that, I'll give you some examples. I think that'd be a good way then just to talk through this then, to make this come alive for people listening to this podcast. So to start off with, what are some of the examples then of gendered issues and how, what do they...
Okay, let's take a contemporary example that cuts across quite a lot of things, which is how the welfare state has changed since the impact of the 2008 banking crisis and the kinds of austerity-type policies that we've seen. And if we focus specifically on the UK, so we've seen a kind of cutback in funding to the public sector and a different kind of relationship that's come out of that. We think about welfare and we think about the relationship between individual citizens and the state in quite a different way as a result of that. Now, if we take that, go back to 2008 and we look at who made the decisions about whether we would follow quantitative easing or whether we would take a more Keynesian approach and invest in the economy and try and do that. All of those people making those decisions, particularly at the high level, were men. And they were making it in areas of policy that they had experience of around defence, taxation and those high-level priorities. And at no point did they take into account how those decisions would impact on particular groups of society. Women as one group of that, and they're a very obvious example to take because they're the biggest group of that. But also there are areas around you, people living in poverty, people experiencing disability, and all those are kinds of things that they didn't really take that into account when making those very high-level initial decisions about what do we do in the face of this huge global banking crisis. Then, if you look at the impact of that in terms of the decisions that were taken around cuts to public services, cuts to welfare, you can actually, if we unpick it, women are taking the impact of that about 75% of the impact of cuts to welfare falls on women.
And there was very good Fawcett Society analysis.
Absolutely.
That, wasn't there?
Yeah. There's some very good Fawcett Society. There's also some very good work done by colleagues of mine in the Women's Budget Group down in London, and also specifically in Scotland, in the Scottish Women's Budget Group and from Engender. If people want to go and Google those and have a look at those reports, they're very, very interesting. And nobody sort of looking at that construction would say that the patriarchal society or the patriarchal policymakers set out to shaft women in terms of the economic and social policy outcomes. But whether intended or not, the consequences have disproportionately fallen on women. And then as we look at it from a welfare perspective and we try and understand how that's happened, it's actually quite a complicated thing. And the first instance, we look at the impact, for example, on cuts to the public sector and jobs. We then uncover, when we look behind that, that the majority of people working, not all of them, but the majority of people working in the public sector, particularly working in the low-paid frontline jobs that are the source of jobs that are going to get cut and are being cut, the majority of them are women. Then we look at the way in which that has an impact, for example, on people's experiences of unemployment. We know that women are more likely to work part-time because of childcare commitments, but also because of other commitments. So, and we also know that people who work part-time tend to be the first people who face redundancy, and they also tend to have the least employment protection and the least employment security. So when we start unpacking that, and we can look at things like the gender pay gap, which is why, even though in 1970 we passed the Equal Pay Act, we still have the average gender pay gap in Scotland is at about 75%, which means that women earn 75% of the salaries that men earn. But when you unpick it even more, women who are working part-time earn around 60% of the income that men working similar levels of hours do. And the gap gets even wider when you compare hourly levels with women working part-time, men working full-time. And so all of that. And also, you're more likely to be working part-time in the public sector. You're more likely to have things like term-time-only contracts or part-time working in care work and teaching assistance-type work and those kind of low-paid jobs. And the other thing is it then highlights the value that we put on those kinds of jobs, which, again, is another complicated aspect, but it's still all linked to this kind of trying to understand how welfare works.
It also flags to me sort of a longer standing issue of sort of like one of the key topics in social policy is how do we tackle poverty, and it highlights to me how poverty itself might be gendered.
I think it does. It's a good example to look at, because we know that the best route out of poverty is to work, and that's why we have activation policies throughout Europe and particularly within the UK, why we've shifted our focus and in the last 20 years in particular towards a welfare-to-work approach, trying to get people in poverty into the labour market, because that's the best route out of work, out of poverty. And also the best route out of all the things that go along with poverty, like ill health, morbidity, and things like the Glasgow effect, where you've got lots of people in Glasgow having much shorter life expectancy, etc., than could be expected. Now, but if you unpack that even more, you've got the tendency for women, again, to work part-time and in lower-waged work. That means that over their life course, they're earning less than men, which means they're paying less into their pensions. That partly explains why women, even though when they've left the labour market over the age of 65, are much more likely to experience poverty than men. The other reason is that they're more likely to take time out of the labour market because of caring commitments. And that is partly a kind of social construction of our expectations of what's appropriate for each gender to do. Mothers do that rather than fathers. But it's also backed up by lots of kind of structural issues around policy that encourages them to do that. So, for example, we pay people maternity leave, but only very, very limited paternity leave, so that women are encouraged mothers of young children are encouraged to take time out from the labour market, and fathers aren't.
I suppose it's also worth flagging as well that, yes, it's sort of breaks from the labour market through care for children, but also increasingly care for older relatives as well, sort of parents and grandparents.
It is.
As well.
And that's an interesting one, because then we can take another look at it, if we're looking at it in terms of welfare generally, is who provides welfare? It's not just, welfare is not just the state giving us income and benefits, or even just giving us services. A lot of the welfare that we get comes from families, communities, and the wider society. And there is increasingly reliance on that kind of informal kind of welfare rather than state-provided welfare. But again, when we look behind that, we discover that's very gendered. That means there's an awful lot of expectation, again, for example, on mothers to take time out, look after their children, but on people to provide informal or unpaid care for disabled relatives and elderly relatives. And then also for grandparents to provide childcare for working mothers. So there's an awful lot of intergenerational expectations that are happening. Those expectations are very gendered. We expect grandmothers to do different things from grandfathers. We expect daughters to do different things to sons. So there's a very complicated mix of values, theories, and to explain this. But the role that, when we're looking at it from a welfare perspective, the role that the state plays in shoring up this kind of system, this highly gendered system, because it's actually relying on the unpaid care of largely women, is really, really interesting.
And I suppose in some respects as well, there's a path dependency there going right back to the founding of the welfare state. Well, I'm just writing out to my students this, that it's not in 1945. Actually, the welfare state was founded prior to that, but the welfare state since the 19th century has been predicated on the male breadwinner model.
Absolutely. It has been predicated on this idea that we have one person in the family who works, and that will probably overwhelmingly be the man. Hmm. Doesn't necessarily have to be the man. And another way of looking at that is a single breadwinner model, where you could have particularly women in high incomes being the breadwinner. But we do know that in families an awful lot of work goes on that is not about going out to work and earning money. It's about looking after children, it's about looking after the house, and it's about participating in your wider community, looking after grandparents and relatives as well. So there is this idea that somebody else does that work and isn't engaging in the paid labour market because they're doing that work, and that work is just as necessary as the paid work, although it's not valued by being paid for it, and that we have an inbuilt gendered assumption, because historically that always was the case, and it certainly was the case in the 40s when we constructed the kind of welfare state that we have now, that women would be doing that work. So we still have an income replacement based benefit system that looks at the family as a unit, for example, instead of assessing each individual person's contribution and giving them individual benefits. You take into account partners, so you look at them as a partnership unit, and it's usually a heterosexual partnership unit, and male and female, that is looked at as a model of that. And so income is judged as being at a family. Now, another unintended consequence of this, for example, is that we know that women are disproportionately at risk of domestic abuse and violence. That isn't to say that men do not experience domestic abuse and violence. They do. But it is 90% of the victims of that are women. And an awful lot of the victims of that, particularly because their circumstances dictate that they can't actually leave the violent situation as easily, are women living in poverty. So if we have a situation where all of the income goes to the head of the household, and that head of the household is presumed to be the man, and that man, who's potentially an abuser, has an awful lot of power within that household. And he can literally stop women getting access to money and income and resources and stop them being able to leave violent relationships.
And famously, as even as Timmins shows in his Five Giants book, that's why child benefit was paid to the women, was paid to the mother, and that's a change from family allowance before. It was to stop men using that, either, well, is the sort of somewhat sexist notion that men would just waste on beer, but also the much more the argument that came from poverty campaigners in the 1970s of men were using this to abuse their wives.
There is that. There is also a bit of evidence that is not actually sexist, in that it's empirically based.
Yeah.
In that it's not just about abusing your wife, it's about controlling the resources.
Resources.
So we do know from lots of evidence about how money gets used in families, particularly in low-income families, that men use it, are more likely to use it on things that either are for themselves or for the family, but in a kind of an external kind of way. So you think of it that they are the ones who will buy the cars. Mm. They are the ones who will probably be paying the mortgage. Mm. They are the ones who invest in that. Whereas money that comes into women's pockets goes much more directly on children. Mm. So even if, whether that's earning or state benefits, it's the pattern is exactly the same. So women tend to pay for the childcare. Women tend to pay for children's food, upkeep, etc. So that, again, was the thinking behind why we give child benefit directly to mothers, or as it is now, primary caregivers. Mm. So people can opt now to choose who the primary caregiver is. So it's slightly less sexist, but the outcome is still the same. Right. And for a lot of women, that was the only income that went directly to their pockets, particularly low-income women.
Yeah.
So that was a bit of resource that was quite powerful. And taking that away from women, even though the argument was about, and it's a legitimate argument, it's about when you've got restricted resources, do you target them on the poorest families or do you give them more universally to families? And the argument was made that actually it's fairer to target them on the poorest families, so higher income families don't no longer get child benefit. But that's an important source of income that used to go directly to women and no longer does.
Yeah. And we'll probably go back to this later, so probably not worth dwelling on it just now, but it's one of the criticisms of universal credit as well as that element of it. But I suppose the other thing that that's come to my mind when you've been talking as well, though, is when we look at the work that looks at the way problem populations are framed in social policy, and the work of scholars such as Imogen Tyler and Lisa McKenzie recently, and the way that women are problematised in a lot of our welfare discourses as well. And I'm particularly thinking in terms of the importation of the welfare queen model into UK political discourse. There's actually flatly, well, contradicting the work it's opposite to what you've just said of this idea that we have these women who are immoral and just have children to get benefits and that sort of aspect of it.
Well, an interesting case study, if you want to look at any welfare system and see how it treats people, is to look at how it treats lone parents, because by unpicking that, you unpick an awful lot of the values that underpin the policies, an awful lot of assumptions that are made, usually along gendered lines, about appropriate behaviour, and then an awful lot of assumptions that are made about people living in poverty, because lone parents are overwhelmingly women, and they're overwhelmingly people living in poverty. So we've moved within the UK from a system and a kind of value-based system which almost mythologised the mother. So that was absolutely the case. You know, she should be protected. She should be at home looking after her children. A lot of psychological work in the post-war period, people like John Bowlby, an attachment theory that said that young children were damaged irreparably by being away from their parents, particularly away from the mother. A lot of focus on the role of the mother in bringing up children. So until probably the 70s or so, there was this expectation that women would be home looking after children, and that would be the norm. And that if they were lone parents, and 90% of lone parents are women, that the state should support them in that. So the state always gave women not a decent income, but the expectation that if there was no father providing, the state would step in and provide for that family. Now, that radically changed. Those assumptions radically changed at the end of the 70s and the 80s and the 90s. And as you said, there are now alternative discourses. Mm. You've mentioned this idea of women who live off the welfare state being kind of parasites and the underclass, etc. We also have the almost fetishization of work as being the be-all and end-all. So lone parents are now encouraged into work. And one of the most arguably successful policies that we've seen in terms of New Labour's policy around the 90s around not just child benefit particularly, but focusing on children's welfare and children's poverty, was about getting their mothers into work. Mm. So children's centres, etc., all about providing childcare, supporting mothers, particularly lone mothers and low-income mothers, into work. So there's a big neoliberal discourse there about work and individualisation.
Although even that, I think I always find that really interesting because it's, as Ruth Lister argues, it was there was that, but it was also a very canny way of shifting the political discourse towards child poverty because it was a way to slip progressive policies under the radar because like nobody wants to not hurt children.
Absolutely. Children are the be-all and end-all of the welfare state. And every kind of policy, whether it's about investing in education or investing in work programmes, is all about the future and economic sustainability. But we're, you know, children's capacity to work as part of the state, to be part of that citizenship and society. And she wrote a wonderful article which was Children Not Women First, which was exactly about that idea that you've just presented, which was that from a feminist perspective, for the lot of the reasons I've just said, we would argue for women to have independent access to their own resources and their own income. And then you could argue about whether that's through work and participation in the market or whether that should be through the state. The Scandinavian model does very much say some of that income should come from the state and should support women, whereas the neoliberal argument within the UK says actually most of that income should come from work. That's why we push women who are mothers into work. But this discourse of actually no, we don't address women's poverty and we don't address women's equality, but we do it, we actually focus on child poverty, child inequality, and perhaps, you know, the longitudinal costs of child poverty, which we do know that your children's expectations for the life are pretty much dictated by the time they're five. Yeah. So what kind of income bracket they're going to end up in when they leave school, what kind of educational opportunities they're going to have, what kind of class they're going to end up in. By the time the welfare state in the form of universal education gets in there, it's too late. So you actually have to find a way. If you are thinking progressively about how you tackle poverty and inequality, you have to think how you get in there early and how you affect the outcomes of children, particularly children born in poverty. And so how you do that is you get their mothers into work at the moment rather than giving their mothers support to look after them. And you also get children into childcare, formal childcare, which has the lovely consequence of it frees their mothers up to work. So it's all about getting mothers into work, and it's all about this neoliberal ideology. And it's not about really recognising the unpaid care that women do or valuing that unpaid contribution to society. And they've done it, as you've pointed out, very neatly by focusing on children rather than women. Because who would argue with a focus on children? It would be evil. Nasty people.
I suppose and the other aspect of that for me, and there's not been much critical work on this, I've sort of seen pieces by Bridget Daniel here on it, is that sort of the subtle element around mothers and the increasing growth of parenting and family interventions in policy. And you particularly see this in Scotland, as this is because of the partly because of the devolution settlement and the limited powers of the Scottish government, but this focus on improving parenting skills and intervening in families as a way to alleviate poverty rather than actually maximising income in the household. And it's another very subtle way that that sort of welfare queen, this kind of the irresponsible mother arguments come into policy.
I mean, there's a lovely piece I was reading recently that was a qualitative piece of work, again, linked to the work done by Bridget Daniel, etc., on child neglect, etc., particularly, which looked at children's services that were constructed around particularly young mothers and single mothers bringing their children into spaces where they were then to be encouraged to play with their children and to interact in that lovely kind of middle-class family way, which is about reading to them and educating them. And the spaces were working for the women because there were lots of sofas there, because and they got to sit down and talk to the other mums. And that dealt with a lot of issues they were dealing with, like social isolation and all of those kinds of things. But from the perspectives of the people doing that work, they didn't work because it didn't get the women acting as mums and interacting with their children. So they took the sofas away and they made them stop talking to each other and start talking to the children. And there's a lovely thing about that, which is about, yes, there is a particularly not just gendered, but a class-based idea of what good parenting is there. And it's about being lovely and getting down on the floor with your children, reading to them. It's not about chatting to other mums. Now, of course, the mums that weren't, you know, subject to that, who take their children to the park whilst texting each other on their mobile phones, or who would take them out to posh lunches and talk to each other and ignore their children completely while they're in posh high chairs, were not subject to the gaze of the state in terms of that. So that, you know, their mothering was about social interaction with other mothers as well, and that kind of peer support that is very, and anyone who's been through being a mother knows that that is actually incredibly important in terms of your own sanity and ability to survive. The fact that that is not subject to state intervention means that middle class mothers can get away with it, but low income mothers not allowed to get away with it.
Also, for me, that's a really parallels McDermott's analysis of the Poverty and Social Exclusion Survey, where she showed that actually, if you look at mothers who are experiencing material poverty and low-income mothers, their parenting skills, as we call them, are just like anybody else. They spend the same amount of time reading with their children, the same amount of time helping them with their homework. And actually, what the weird parents are high-income parents who are the helicopter parents who have their children doing far too many activities, are spending far too much time with their children,
so
actually in a probably a more damaging way. But as you say, they're not the ones that we worry about, that are portrayed as problematic in society.
And all of the evidence that comes from, not from necessarily from social sciences, but from the psychological sciences about, you know, what constitutes a good mother and good parenting and what constitutes to those good outcomes for children indicates that you have to be a good enough parent. That being a too good parent is just as bad, as you point out, as being a really neglectful parent. And that this cuts across the class divide completely. Being a good enough parent is a universal attribute that we all kind of do because we muddle along. And we're better at it, incidentally, if we have lots of peer support. If we have lots of other mums to talk to and swap hints and tips, and also stop us all going completely mad and losing it on our kids, kind of thing. So that idea is very kind of, it's become a very class-based interventionist thing that the state does to reinforce a very gendered approach to parenting, but also a very class based approach to parenting that isn't actually backed up by what the evidence says is good parenting anyway.
And I suppose the other element of sort of thinking particularly on gender and poverty is, it's as a feminist myself, I always highlight that patriarchy creates two gender roles. It creates men and women, but it's also the absurd fact that the focus on the problematization of women and poverty means that actually at the moment it's young single men who are being particularly screwed over by the welfare state at the moment. I think the Joseph Rowntree Foundation has done some really interesting work on that, as they're recently, they're a group that's just completely missed because nobody cares about them. They've not got kids, essentially, so they're not a problem.
Although they probably did vote in huge numbers to exit the EU. But anyway, the other interesting aspect in terms of social divisions to bring into this, if we're focusing on, you know, parenting, is race. And the way in which black parenting is problematised. Because you do have an awful lot of low-income black and ethnic minority households headed by women. And the men are absent. Now, if you look again at the psychological evidence about absent fathers. Fathers who are absent because they're working 50 plus hours a week in a helicopter somewhere in Switzerland and never come home and see their children are just as absent as fathers who have left because of low income or lack of marriage, etc. But it's the black families living in poverty that are problematized in terms of the psychological damage and the social damage to their children. It's not the white middle-income families.
And those, yeah, those elements of intersection are really interesting. And the other element of that I found recently in research looking at census data in Scotland is the withdrawal of women, Muslim women, from the labour market when they have children because of social pressures, the cultural pressures on them to be the mother at home, are so great that their gap from the labour market in their 30s when they're having children is far greater than it is for any other ethnic group in Scotland as well. So those families are going to be, those women's, their lives will be negatively affected by that, and also the family's life will be affected by that.
And that highlights, you know, if we take a step back from it and take a, okay, if we take, we're asking the big feminist question, which is how can we deal with inequality, the inequality experienced by women? Do we, on the one hand, recognise that women are overwhelmingly the carers, the looking after children, looking after older people, looking after disabled people, and somehow recompense them for that kind of work, which isn't valued by the market, isn't valued by society as much as taking part in paid work, it certainly isn't valued by policymakers as taking part in paid work? Or do we try and get women to be more like men, participate in public life, get them into the workforce, get them being paid more and doing that kind of thing? And then we have a problem of, well, there's still a whole bunch of children and old people and disabled people need looking after. Does the state intervene to do that for them? Does the market intervene to do that for them? Then you see income distribution. So the middle-class women who can afford childcare for their women, for their children, sorry, are going to be disproportionately much less at risk of poverty and inequality than perhaps lower-income women or black and ethnic minority women who can't afford childcare or wouldn't want childcare for social and cultural reasons. So there's all sorts of really complicated and interesting questions for social policy about that. But you do have to take a gendered perspective to understand all of the things that are going on there.